long range planning commission meeting?
Liveliness in the sound as we were.
September 22nd, 1995.
Let's see if it makes, it shouldn't make any difference at all.
It's 13:14 right now, and this will be a video conference with Brian Rogers chairing.
I'm ready.
Okay. Steve is, was looking at the scenarios, composite number four last night, obviously, after we handed it out and had our meeting. He said the scenarios labeled composite are tending to move more and more toward the higher and higher income taxes in order to support higher and higher levels of dividend payments. This is the wrong direction. So that was the comments that he wrote, and he said he'd try to be in and this afternoon.
Okay. I expect that he's not speaking for only one member of the commission when he says that.
I'm not going to try to guess.
Let's go to Juno, and Ann Lee, do you want to start with working on the draft or how we treat federal and other non-general funds? Okay, did you hear Steve Rieger's statement?
Yes, we did get that.
Okay, the other two items then, we've got as the major items for today's agenda, the treatment of federal and other non-general funds, and then the material, the draft that you distributed last night. Do you have a preference as to which one to start with?
My preference would be if we did the drafts, because we don't have a financial statement kind of numbers thing to show on the treatment of the federal fund, but maybe we can get at it through the draft materials, see if people feel comfortable with what we're outlining there, and then talk about, we just didn't have a chance to do that this morning.
Our artist or our person that's putting it together is incommunicado in Anchorage.
Okay. All right, let's go to the draft. I don't have the draft here. They're being delivered to, probably not for another half hour. I'll just listen.
Brian, I could send them up.
I'm
sorry, Ann Lee.
You want to send them up, Bob?
I can fax them up to you. I'll go upstairs and get them and fax them right over to you.
Thank you. I apologize. I expected I'd be back in my office before the meeting.
Not a problem. Here's Commissioner Gorsuch.
Welcome, Lee.
Hi, Ryan.
Well, Ann Lee, why don't you go ahead and start, and all that. I read it all last night, so I'm familiar with the material, and I'll just catch up with the actual draft when we get here.
Okay. What I'd be interested in now is feedback from people as we go through on areas of this draft that you think need change or this approach is wrong. I start out, as I mentioned, with a description of each of the categories of funds as a group, and describe what is the characteristic of that fund, how is it treated in the budget currently. That seem okay to people? And I just listed the categories that are in Nancy's chart.
Is that okay with you, Hugh?
I'm trying to catch up. Is this on page one on the pieces in the budget puzzle?
Right.
Okay.
The next thing would be to describe the changes that we think should be incorporated in the budget process, and to identify that, make it clear to people that not all reductions in expenditures close the fiscal gap. In other words, if they're not the sort of pure general fund, they won't close the fiscal gap. Just a word or two about the federal and other types of restrictions, and this whole issue of fee-supported activities, which is that one that we were discussing last night. That would be the you know, my thought would be this would probably take about two pages worth of description of this stuff, and then I move into the recommendations for how this should be improved in the future. In 97 was showing, we show general fund, the permanent fund, earnings, dividends, inflation proofing, etc. Federal funds, interagency receipts, and corporate receipts on a comparative basis, 96 to 97. And I did have a column that showed what is the change on the fiscal gap.
Experimenting here, Annalee.
I get dizzy if I watch you.
Okay.
This would be in our spending plan, which summarizes and currently shows only general funds, would then show all of these categories of funds. What Nancy and I have talked about as a possibility for 97 is after comparing 96 and 97 for all these activities, we could then show the total spending for things like the loan programs, et cetera, and listing that at the bottom.
Do you have a spreadsheet, Annalee, that would give us some idea of this infamous $5.6 billion versus the 2.4 general fund?
That's the piece that Brad mentioned that they're working on, Marta Frankel from Revenue is working on. We were unable to reach her in Anchorage today, so we don't have that to send you yet.
But are these the general categories that add up to the additional $3.2 billion?
That's right. In those categories, oh, you know, I just feel like the one that I dropped off the list is permanent funds.
Right. That's a billion.
Those categories, please come need to go. Those categories track the chart that Nancy had given us about two meetings ago that we will include as appendix, which will be a listing here of all of those accounts, the amount that is the end of year balance for 95, the 96 appropriation, and then some little description of each fund. And then this listing in the appendix would give people the detail about these categories. So they can see exactly what the breakdown is of loan funds, for instance, the breakdown of the special types of revenue funds, rail belt energy, all those sorts of things would be listed in the appendix.
Now, Annalee, in looking at things like retirement funds and loan funds and trust funds in particular, do you know how those are actually booked? I mean, are those annually appropriated fund balances? Are they transaction authorizations each year? Let's just take retirement funds as an example. Is what is actually appropriated the employee contributions to the retirement fund, or is it the earnings of the retirement fund principal, or what shows up here in that category, for example?
I don't know all the details on that fund. We do make an appropriation in the budget this year. It's $15.6 billion for PERS and $1 million for PERS. Those are specifically in the appropriations bills in what's called the front section. So as with many of these other funds that people think are off budget, loan funds are another example, PCE, all of those show up in the front section of the budget currently. I'm going to be redoing the budget format of the appropriations bill format for this coming year. We're not going to have the same kind of front section stuff where it's hard to identify. You have to go through lots of words in order to find out the stuff that's being done.
Right.
We're turning it more into a chart-like form so that it will be something that comes across more easily as a budget document rather than a narrative like a regular piece of legislation.
Mm-hmm.
I'm hoping that as well as the way we portray it in the front of the or in the summary materials on the budget will be much clearer to people as to what are all the funds and what are the balances and the amount that's being appropriated for the year.
Lee, I believe that the only this is Bruce, and I believe that what the legislature appropriates on PERS is the people that administer it. you know, the salaries of the individuals that are directly involved in the ministry for the system. Because they pay their own way on that, like health insurance.
Yeah, so I wasn't quite sure then, Bruce, on the, when it shows retirement retirement funds, whether it would just be the administrative cost that shows up there, or is it something more than that? Because the employer contribution is already covered under the general fund appropriations. So I wasn't quite sure what would be under this category, just as an example, other than the administrative cost.
I think that Bruce is right, that the administrative costs that are shown in the budget.
Yeah.
Those things will be in the notes, but Nancy is not all finished yet. The notes that would go to the chart that would be in the appendix, and that will say what it's for.
Right.
But we also, like in the budget documents for next year, we will also be showing, as we this information is currently made available for the legislature, the loan balances and the actual activity in the loan program, not just the administrative costs. Those loan funds themselves are not currently appropriated, but we do provide the information to the legislature of what the amount totals and what the loan volume is and all that jazz. There's a separate section of the budget detail books that goes through that.
And then, Annalee, on the on getting back to the what people are most familiar with in terms of the general fund, when the general fund dollars are shown, and then there, I don't recall whether or not it's broken down further or if it's just other funds. Is it your predisposition at this point to actually break those out in terms of federal funds, program receipts, and other related or identifiable sources, or were you thinking of a different strategy in terms of capturing more detail on what these non-general fund dollars are?
Right now in the budget documents as they've been so far, we will continue this. We do have a separate column for federal funds, a column for general fund program receipts, pure general fund, and other. We have not broken down the other category in the budget detail, although there are notes that explain what type of revenue source each of those others would be. And we would follow that same pattern. We would still provide additional breakdowns. What I'm going to do this year, though, that will be different is the summary information that most people see when they see the $2.47 billion budget. Right now, that's just general fund. What we're going to do is run a separate column. There will be one that will show general funds. So for those people who want it, who are still thinking in terms of 2.47 kinds of comparisons, they'll have that. But then parallel to that will be another listing that will be total funds, which will include not only the general funds, but also permanent funds, federal funds, and other. The other category generally includes things like some corporate receipts and some sort of weirdo types of funding sources, you know, odd little things that are not, that are very unique to a particular program.
Well, Annalee, the existing budget also lists by agency a breakdown of all those other funds. I assume you're planning
That's
on
right.
continuing that, aren't you?
Yes, we would. And part of what I'm talking about is that is the summary material that gives what has been referred to as a total state budget, which, as we know, is not the total state budget. So that thing is that's called the spending plan, which you're, of course, familiar with, Brian, but the spending plan will now show not just general funds, but there'll be a general funds column and then a column that shows all the other stuff that's there, federal and federal, et cetera. Now, what will be different than the current budget process altogether, though, is that we have in our individual department information shown federal funds, general fund, other, et cetera. We have never shown the permanent fund earnings, and dividends, and inflation improving as part of the overall spending plan. So that would change.
And the railroad, for example, how are we handling the railroad?
What I've got currently in the works for the 97 process, and I'm open to the suggestions for changes to this, is that we will have a brief synopsis of those sort of quasi-independent corporations, ADA, Railroad, et cetera, Science and Technology Foundation, in the summary materials for the budget. They're not subject now to the Executive Budget Act. So for this go around, we wouldn't be packaging that with, you know, their budgets with all of the other stuff, probably. But we will be having the summary of their information in the budget book itself.
Well, there is an issue, Annalee, that I think is important, at least for us to be cognizant of, and that is some of these quasi-public entities do have state assets in them, which are subject to at least potential reappropriation, in contrast to others which are not. An example would be retirement funds are not subject to this. At least my understanding is they would not be subject to a reappropriation, in contrast to ADA or AHFC, which could be. And it seems to me that we want to try to isolate in categories those assets that could be liquidated and reappropriated, in contrast to those that are really under contractual law off limits without the significant penalty, because to hold them off gives the impression that somehow, just because they're quasi, they're not under the under the scrutiny of the commission. And since we know several of them have been the targets of legislative inquiry, from the science and technology to AHFC to ADA, I think it's appropriate that they be in somewhat of a separate category, because they are continually under scrutiny, and the state does have a prerogative as to whether they would continue or discontinue them. So I don't have a recommendation to make about their continuance or discontinuance, but I do think it's important that they're in a category where that really is a state asset that is subject to appropriation should we so choose to make that policy call. Whereas other funds, federal funds, program receipts, are not subject to appropriation. We can turn them down, but we can't reappropriate them.
Why don't I make some notes about that in the intro, where I was going to just describe briefly what these types of categories of funds are. Why don't I put in that kind of note? So, for instance, in the section on retirement funds, I would specifically mention these are not funds that could be reappropriated for other purposes. And then outline which are available. You'll see in the my draft here, I propose that for FY98, we do whatever we can in the 97 budget process, and then in FY98, one of the recommendations is that we have a 3-year plan for reviewing all of these and making determinations about whether we want to reappropriate or whether we want to maintain these funds for the purposes that they're currently serving. Or whether we
want to
scale them back or whatever.
And along that same.
My understanding that.
I'm sorry, go ahead.
I guess I'm kind of assuming that none of us are going to feel in a position now to say, before between now and October 1st, we think ADA should be A, B, or C, expanded, closed down, maintained the same. But that what we should be recommending is a process for being sure that evaluation is made as soon as it's responsible. Is that kind of what you all are thinking?
Well, that's what I would feel more comfortable. I don't know if you had a different thought on it. The other, it's a similar category, Annalee, and I don't think it's as significant, but I don't know the answer to this. What other state assets are on the inventory that could be sold or privatized if, in fact, the state so chose to go in that area? Again, this is a very knotty problem. I don't know that there's that much money in it, but the state does own a lot other than natural resources in terms of facilities and portfolios. And some of that could be under the discussion about whether or not the state would move to privatize. We had a brief conversation, for example, around some of the nursing home options as it might relate to some state facilities. Again, we're in no position to really make a recommendation on that, but it is a category of an asset that has a book value or a market value and could be used in some gap closing measure.
I do refer to that kind of thing in the spending cut section. Why don't I after the column of all the different types of funds, I've added in something, categories for the independent corporations or quasi-independent corporations, and then I'll do a little thing on state land and facilities and the other non, sort of the hard assets as opposed to the cash type thing.
Yeah.
So there's also some reference in here, Lee, for instance, in the loan section, which is one of the things identified for 98, that we could consider selling off loan portfolios. So I think there are a number of references throughout here to the kinds of things that you're talking about. And maybe you all can flag for me as we go through if there are any other places where you want to incorporate those kinds of references. Does anybody else see anything missing from that list on the first page of the types of the funds with the additions that I just mentioned and the permanent fund, which somehow I missed when I was typing this?
Analia. Bruce, you need to put the microphone close to you. We can't hear you.
I'm sorry. Saying that there's about 15 million in health insurance funds. That's in part employees' money, in part stabilization reserve, and in part residual liabilities. But it ought to be listed somewhere.
Well, you mentioned the issue of the employee fund. What's the status of the investment loss trust fund? Have the employees been paid for their losses yet?
No, it's actually maintained, as I understand it, and I was talking to our attorneys yesterday about it, they're going to try to collapse that this year. Real soon, like in the next week or so, they're going to get the last payment out of California from the bankruptcy. And they want to collapse that fund. Right now, they have to send two statements out to employees, one your regular SBS, the other from the Investment Loss Trust Fund. So they don't want to do that anymore.
Is there going to be an excess in the Investment Loss Trust Fund after employees are fully compensated for their losses?
To the extent that the Investment Loss Trust Fund fully or mostly fully funded the original loss, all the money that they've got back in, I think, went back into the general fund, didn't it? We got a $30 million payment last year.
Yeah, we're sitting with about $130 million right now in the Investment Loss Trust Fund. But with my understanding that most of that would be going to the participants, I don't know whether there was residual or not. That's in the notes that Nancy had done on this chart as of last week. That was the status.
I think the other money that we've gotten back from that is going right into the general fund.
Oh, okay. Thanks.
Last year, I think we got a $32 million payment.
And that did go into the general fund, right?
Yeah. So I don't think there would be any left.
Not sure. Emily, I think this is a really clear explanation of the pieces of the budget puzzle. And I think when we add to it the graphic representation that's underway, that it will clarify pretty well for people why there are different numbers you can talk about, and may help explain why we chose to focus on the GF in the preliminary report, but we'll make people aware of how these pieces interrelate.
Maybe I should do a little bit before going into the changes for 97. I amplify this a little bit about sort of a little intro to indicate that we really felt strongly that we're not getting the best full picture that we could, but that the magnitude of some of these changes is pretty substantial, and we think it is going to require a couple of years to get through it. But reassure people that the money is being appropriated and so on. I think that's part of our education responsibility, because there's been an impression out there that somehow a lot of this money is just floating around there, never having any attention from the executive or legislative branches, and that simply isn't true. So
Well, I think it is true it never gets attention from some legislators.
Yeah, and it doesn't get enough from any of them. But
don't put that in the report, though.
Okay.
Annalise.
Yeah, I do want to just chime in, Brian, and say that I apologize. I'm late again and just picked this up, so I'm kind of going through it as you all are talking. And that first page really does look good, Annalise, that in reading the Anchorage editorial, I think it was yesterday on the plane, mm-hmm. I thought, oh, you know, here we go again. And it just puts a question mark in the public mind that we're not showing them the whole picture. So I think that this is a good approach.
Annalise, I don't know if we have, the time to devote to any of this, but for example, under the federal funds, you know, I haven't heard a lot of clamor to reduce Alaska's receipt of federal funds, and yet the truth of the matter is, in some categories that might be, for example, as we were talking about the road construction, it carries with it, and even though it might be a 90-10 federal receipt, the O&M cost on it to the state actually exceed the cost of the initial capital. So I think in some cases we might want to at least add a paragraph that tries to explain a little bit further as to why these topics are off, and specifically why we may not wish to be showing comparisons with other states unless we think it's really appropriate. And I think in the case of the federal funds and the use of the interhighway funds is a good example where at least the argument Senator Stevens has used is that our road infrastructure is way behind that of other states, and therefore he argues why we should be entitled to a larger share of those receipts. So if you looked at it as federal highway dollars per capita, it would look very different than if you did it as federal dollars per road. But I think some explanation as to why these comparisons in some cases may not be appropriate with other states. We were talking at our last meeting about how many states have a whole series of dedicated funds which for practical purposes are regarded as off budget and are not included in some of these national reporting statistics. And so when someone tries to aggregate all of these and divide it by a per capita and then compare it to other states, it is not a reasonable comparison. And I think we need to try to at least do the best we can about what is comparable and what is not. Again, all that needs to be done within a page.
Well, I have referred in the spending section on page 7 that while leveraging federal funds is an important thing to think about, we have to be sure that the program is worth doing. I've done it in terms of programs here. I'll mention capital facilities as well. And add in a thing about O&M. It's on the smart investment part.
Well, one of the best examples, Annalise, are in terms of building hospitals that wind up where you wind up with more beds and lower utilization rates that then drive up the overall cost of the beds that are used, and it really hasn't had any positive impact at all. And even though the construction of the bed space was, quote, free, the cost of it is, in fact, borne by all those who pay for their medical care or their medical care's insurance.
Yep, okay. I think I've got some notes that I can flesh that out with. In the package of things that we would be recommending for 97 budget, one is how we show all the funds in the first paragraph there at the bottom of page 1, and also making clear which things help close the fiscal gap, which don't. On the second item about funds for revenues and legal expenditures. I've added a note that I want to be sure to say that this is not just a license to raise fees, going to the point that Judy made last night. It's something we've talked about with the department. Just because something is fee supported doesn't mean we aren't going to scrutinize it and try and make it cheaper. And then the last part on HFC will be under the executive budget tax this year, so that will increase the scrutiny right off the bat. And then we'll have overview information on the other corporations. Is there anything else that people would like me to add to the 97 package on this pieces of the puzzle part? We have a bunch, maybe seven or eight funds that are kind of temporary holding accounts for accounting purposes only. We are going to review, my recommendation is we review it in 98. I don't think I can tackle this in 97. Get rid of any that aren't really making sense. My thought is that in a lot of these fund areas, we need to collapse things. We've made it much more complicated, and therefore we've increased our cost of accounting and made it more difficult to show what's out there. And then, as I mentioned earlier, the three-year schedule for doing a substantive review of all these funds and determining if we still want to use our state assets this way. And Brian, I did mention if revolving funds are going to be phased out because they're selling the outstanding loans, as you suggested the other day, and closing out inactive loan funds. Are there other things that people would like to suggest adding for the out year recommendations on the puzzle pieces?
Emily, on the pieces of the puzzle, I would actually suggest that maybe you entitle this pieces of the budget puzzle versus parts of the gap, and then break down into two categories, those that are part of the puzzle but don't contribute to the gap versus those that are part of the gap, and that might be a segue into some of our future conversations.
Good idea. Good. Okay. And I'm assuming by that, Lee, that you mean things that could be a part of the gap, not just that they are currently, like
yes.
Science and tech or some of those kinds of things. Okay.
Right.
All right. And then we'll reorganize the that appendix chart to be the same way so that it goes into gap closers and non-gap closers. Although even there, you know, some of that is still sort of tricky in terms of explaining it briefly, Lee, using your federal thing as an example. A federal fund in and of itself is not a gap closer. But if you decide you don't really need to do the federal program, it's not wise, you may free up some general fund matching money that is a gap closer. So I'll do my best to get some of this explained in less than something like 4 feet.
Budgetary finesse.
Any other out year suggestions for that we want to put in the report? Nope. Okay.
Should we move on to the reserve then?
Brian, did you get your copy?
Yes, I did. Thank you.
Okay.
I think if everybody would think about any other items, but if we can just do the pieces versus parts section, this provides a pretty good outline, and the other comments here, I think we've got a pretty thorough treatment of that. So, Emily, again, thanks for your work on this, and let's turn to reserve.
I drafted this section, obviously, as I noted up front, we wouldn't need, if we were going to adopt the endowment plan, we wouldn't need this section, although I think we would still need to address how things like volatility and so on are addressed within the context of a endowment plan, and as you said, Bruce just mentioned catastrophe, so that we acknowledge that we have taken those things into account. But if we end up not doing the endowment plan, the five purposes, anybody have any suggestions on that first section of the five major roles for reserves? And then I just go into a little bit of explanation on the permanent fund. This would be the reserves required if we recommend the Rieger plan. Now, a question here on amount. The calculation that Steve and Brad did on what would be necessary for reserves totals about $1.6 billion. That's what you would need if you had 4 years in a row of low earnings.
That would be negative return.
Negative return, yeah. As we kind of talked about it, it seemed like maybe we didn't need to really go to the penny of what would be required for 4 years of negative returns, on the assumption that we should be bright enough if we see that we're having a couple of years of negative returns in the world economy or whatever is not changing sufficiently. We better do something a little bit more dramatic than just sit around and wait for the payout stuff. So we were assuming that there would begin to be some other changes. You would make some different choices, of not only on the expenditure levels, but also in terms of what you allocate to dividends, inflation proofing, and general fund income. We just wanted to throw out for discussion $1 billion. I've said there, you know, thinking that if you went 2 years, you better start making those changes. Does that seem reasonable to people, or do you feel we should go higher or lower?
Well, the issue of the reserves, I think, Annalee, depends on a problem that has never been solved historically, and that is, how do you get them replenished? It's fine when you've got settlements coming in that make you look like you're sort of up again, but when you don't have that and you've exhausted those, we need to have some mechanism whereby reserves are replenished. And if we have a replenishing characteristic to it, then I think $1 billion is plenty. And in fact, it might even be more than needed. But I think $1 billion gives us a significant commodity price swing. We can deal with the financial market up and downs through some kind of averaging of a payout or a draw. But again, with if we do not go into the endowment plan, I think we do need to figure out a way in which that reserve, if it's called upon, somehow is replenished over time as a essentially a draw on our deposited assets and earnings. It's almost like we're borrowing from ourselves, but historically, our problem has been that we simply spend it down, and then when it's gone, we've lost the function it was designed to play. So I think maybe a paragraph inserting the way in which the reserves have to be managed in order for them to have a perpetual role rather than an episodic one.
Good point. Would we want to recommend that they replenish? I had just been thinking that the replenishment would come as earnings picked up again in the future. There will be an automatic replenishment. We could suggest a speeding up of that.
Isn't it the case that in the scenarios that Brad has run that they that it does, in fact, replenish over the time. If I remember right, the composite now has us annually dumping excess from the CBR in to the permanent fund, and over a regular period, dumping from the permanent fund earnings reserve into the permanent fund. So I think that if we did have a couple of down years, we have built in this cupping ability. I guess in terms of the size of the reserve, that it seems like we'd be better trying to peg it at a percentage of our annual spending rather than using a flat $1 billion, that maybe we're looking at an amount equal to a third of general fund plus permanent fund earnings or some number like that would be the target rather than holding it flat.
This is the reserves for the payout part, not the general fund budget reserve. Would you still think we'd want to do it that way? And actually, I just realized what I didn't put in here, I did put it on the other one, is anything about indexing it.
Brian, there's another, you might want to raise another point about reserves as the six, five roles of a reserves policy. We might want to have one that's as a vehicle for capitalizing current reserves for future earnings.
Well, that's really my feeling, Annalee, is that the permanent fund earnings reserve, as far as I'm concerned, should be inside the permanent fund as a part of its overall management responsibilities and not something which is subject to legislative appropriation. And the constitutional budget reserve is the one that's used for the availabilities for general fund purposes. But I would be inclined to try to use some internal process of internalizing the permanent fund earnings reserve rather than externalizing it as a separate reserve account. Again, I've not thought through all of the implications of that, but I don't like having two reserve funds. I think it confuses people.
Including me. Oh, sorry.
Go ahead.
Right now, the permanent fund earnings reserve account is managed in the same way as the permanent fund by the permanent fund board and so on. It gets the same rate of return. The only difference is that it's not in the corpus, so it could be tapped for something, although, as I've laid out here, it's never been tapped except for the deposit into the corpus. I think the issue you raised about whether we should have one fund or two is a good one. I've heard different opinions as we've gone through the last few weeks.
Well, for example, what I was saying last week, Annalee, and again, it's too bad Will's not here, but my feeling is that when you've got an earnings reserve of $2 billion, that should go into your overall portfolio mix for the permanent fund trustees. So if you're operating on a $17 billion balance and you've got an additional $2 billion in the earnings reserve account, your cash requirements in terms of paper investments is lessened because of the availability of this reserve feature. So my only thought was that's another, admittedly, it's a more micro consideration, but it's not inconsequential in terms of looking at the total asset allocation of the trustees. And I would prefer that they look at this as an integral part of their investment policy, because I think we want to maximize the returns as much as possible. And I think this has a potential influence on the fund's asset allocation.
On the replenishment, back for a second on the replenishment point that Brian was speaking to, do we want to have it as the earnings pick back up, sort of automatic, just lead it that way, that Brian was suggesting, as opposed to any requirement for some kind of a special deposit into the earnings reserve? And by the way, on these two little, I didn't have the information at my fingertips, but the two gaps in information on the top of page 4, it's been 17 years and $4.5 billion.
Mm-hmm.
It's because I'm having a hard time tracking the permanent fund earnings reserve as we now have it versus a budgetary reserve as we describe the functions up above. And
the permanent fund earnings reserve, and maybe I can clarify that, speaks to point number two, the buffer which enables implementation of the Rieger plan.
Yeah, and there's where I thought, and Steve, I don't know if you've given the same thought, my feeling was that could be internalized as a function of the permanent fund management rather than as a separate statutorily created fund. Now, I don't know if that is under the constitutional construction, whether that's possible or not, but I would like to see us have some kind of provision where we keep a budget reserve. The permanent fund maintains some kind of reserve to achieve whatever its payout rules are, however we define that, and that they also have a retained earnings provision so that we don't wind up creating the expectation that all earnings have to be spent, all real earnings, as the Rieger bill provides. It could be subject to appropriation, but it doesn't have to be spent, and I would not want to create the expectation that we don't have the capacity for some retained earnings if, in fact, our reserve requirements are met and our fiscal, financial plan is being met, that we couldn't, as Byron described it, bulk up the fund a little bit. I don't know, Steve, do you have any sense whether that can be done?
Sorry I jumped in late. I'm chasing around before leaving town. But my first reaction, my first reaction is that it would be better to just have the permanent fund not worry about trying to maintain, to the extent that we can, have them not worry about maintaining year-to-year stability, however they do it. Because when you start asking a fund manager to invest in a strategy that will provide a lot of stability and earnings, it's generally at a pretty considerable sacrifice of yield. So I'd rather see them just do the best they can within some pretty wide volatility tolerances, and then somewhere else and have the buffer.
Right, and that's where, Annalee, I think getting back to the revisiting the Constitutional Budget Reserve is it could serve all five of these roles, and you don't need a permanent fund earnings reserve if you structured the CBR correctly. Am I tracking you?
Well, I actually didn't think of it that way because I saw a different role for the CBR than for the earnings reserve. I mean, I suppose in theory you could combine the two with two sets of rules that act on top of each other, but I think that in a discussion that I don't think you were at, when we talked about the earnings reserve, where its sole function was to be able to guarantee a five-year average payout rule is actually coming to pass, it would be real clean and simple and off to the side, and then the Constitutional Budget Reserve could still be used as a way to help implement what is in a lot of these strategies of saying we're going to hold nominal dollar spending constant for X number of years. And so it more cleanly separates two funds with their two separate purposes. So I think that the only concern, and Annalee, you were there that day, it was just a telephone teleconference, that we were concerned about whether to combine them or not at that time was that we were worried that there'd be some inefficiencies if you managed two funds compared to if you managed one and had an overall portfolio that you could manage better. But I think that a good fund manager can do that anyway, can treat two funds as if
Lee,
they were
I
one.
Had I had started off as a fan of trying to have one fund, but I think as we talked through it the other day, I saw some advantages in having this one be separate. You may not have looked at the most recent composite where we don't let the earnings reserve fund build up perpetually. We have put in a provision, or we've kicked in here a deposit into the corpus every time you get over the $1 billion level. So actually, I just realized I didn't refer to that in the text, but since the assets are managed with a permanent fund now, in a sense, that accomplishes, I think, part of what you're talking about of it being looked at overall as part of the fund. I think there is some danger in having the same pot of money used as the gap filler and the year-to-year budget smoother, and also covering the responsibilities on the payout provision. Just in thinking in terms of temptation of the legislature, it may be better to segregate the portion that we're saying is that to cover that five-year payout and keep that as low as we can.
Well, then in the structure, we'd have the need for two types of reserves. This is why I like the endowment.
That's a big number.
Simplify it, yeah.
What do you mean you need a $250 million a year income tax and you've got $2.5 billion sitting out there just in case you need in your checking account?
As long as Mom McKinney.
I'm not opposed. I just don't know how you sell it.
It undermines the strategy. Yeah.
Although a business is certainly used to that. I mean, you don't run a business right down to the, at least you try not to run a business with $0 with nothing in the bank. And families generally try to do that as well. So I'm not sure the concept is as alien as we...
We queried our auditor one time about what kind of reserves we had to carry with the union. Well, it's pretty much 3 months' expenses. So we've been trying to build up a 3 month cushion.
Brian, what's your thought on the one reserve versus two?
I've gone back and forth on the issue of one reserve versus two. It seems to me that we could craft a CDR which included in its function the ability to use CDR funds when there's not enough permanent fund cash flow to pay dividends. I'm concerned that I don't think I'd want a three-quarters vote for that kind of use. And I guess having gone through most of the summer thinking one reserve is best, I'm coming back to thinking two is best. That having the permanent fund earnings reserve separate and solely there as the investment cushion that can be used through normal majority vote process is a better way. I would like to annually dump any excess either into the permanent fund principal or into the CDR is short, or somewhere else, to sort of keep the earnings reserve at the amount we think we need to cover 2 or 3 years of low earnings, which is probably around the $1 billion level, and keep the CDR separate to be the hedge, the tool for cash flow and the surge tank. So I've come back to the two funds model quite by surprise.
And Brian, going back to, we've, to some extent, we've mischaracterized the endowment in the sense that it is either the macro endowment that Roger had more or less envisioned versus working only with the real earnings of the permanent fund. In fact, it is possible that we could not adopt the sort of macro plan that Roger had been the first advocate of and still recommend that the permanent fund draw be of an endowment nature. That is, rather than going with the appropriation of the real earnings, is that you do in fact set a planned payout. And the arguments that I've heard, at least, are that as you move your asset allocations in, even though you may draw down more heavily on your assets in a poor performing year, over the long haul, it should average itself out. So I guess one of the questions I have in my mind is if we did go to the payout rule, that is, reconstruct the permanent fund to be more of an endowment fund rather than our current strategy, that would, in fact, eliminate the reserves and the smoothing function, it would go back into the investment strategy in terms of the asset allocations of the fund. So I guess I would welcome any thoughts that you have about whether or not we're wise to reject an endowment sort of payout rule and investment strategy for the fund, irrespective of whether it becomes the macro fund that we've talked about. If we did go that way, at least as I see it, it eliminates one of these needs. Now, Brian, you've worked with these endowment funds in the past, and I'm not familiar that any of the endowment funds have specific set-asides, but they do have portfolio implications. Can you speak to that, or maybe Steve well, might have a thought?
Yeah, a couple thoughts. First, in looking at that, for example, the composite scenario 4 in nominal dollars, if it's a convenient year, in FY04, where we see a permanent fund principal of $25 million, using an endowment model of, say, 4.5%, that would say that the permanent fund would be spinning off $1.12 million. But under composite scenario 4, we're taking 1.3, I think. Maybe I'm reading. No, I'm sorry. I'm reading that wrong. I don't know. I'm not sure that. Let's see. I'm sorry. My copy is just super far under reading numbers. I'm not sure. I guess the question I have is the if we were taking 5% off each year. Does that equal the same, more, or less dollars than what's currently shown as the dividend amount plus permanent fund earnings minus transfer to earnings reserve? If the answer is that that endowmentizing the permanent fund would yield less money than the composite scenario, then we're worse off in terms of closing the gap. I think in terms of affecting the asset allocation, there's a little more comfort in going with a higher volatility using an endowment spending approach. You can go to a higher level of equity and thus a higher level of average return, but you're only going to pick up probably a percent in the long run over where they are right now. I don't know, Steve, you may have other thoughts on how much further an endowment might be able to go from what they're making today. I don't think you gain a whole lot from it, I guess is what I'm saying.
But just remember, a percent on $20 billion is $200 million.
Yeah, Brian, I think you're probably right. I don't know what it would be, probably, but I think no more than 2%, but, 1 or 2%. What I was going to add is that, there's a trade-off between the discomfort of having your payout based on actual performance, and on the one hand, which gives you a benefit in terms of kind of political protection for the investment policies of the fund, and on the other hand, the other end of that spectrum is a guaranteed payout rule, where I have insulated, on the one hand, your revenue stream very nicely, but you've also insulated the investment policy from, from the public.
But doesn't it force you into? Doesn't that force you into a very conservative investment policy?
I think that I'm comfortable with the 5-year averaging rule because I think it's a good balance between the two. I think that it wouldn't force you into a real conservative investment policy when you have 5 years in which to absorb any 1 year, fluke in investment performance. And I'm really concerned about the payout rule, contrary to a university endowment, where there are just too many temptations to try to, bury a few bad investments in the permanent fund. And if you have a payout rule, it will, who's going to be squawking? They'd be just kind of a voice in the wind, and no one say, I'm still getting my $400 million a year out of the permanent fund. Who cares if we took a couple of underwater real estate investments in Anchorage and Fairbanks and made the permanent fund viable. You know, it's just, I think that it's real important to keep that link, because then you have, all of Alaskans are a constituency for good investment performance, and they'll be watching. So, I mean, but anyway, the point is, it's a trade-off between the discomfort of the volatility is a plus and a minus. And it seems to me that the five-year average is a good middle ground, and there's nothing magic about that. It might be a six-year average or a four-year, but something like that.
Is there a way that can be done and still be regarded as part of the corpus of the fund? What I'm concerned about is that as long as it appears on the state's financial sheet as a liquid asset, if you will, that's subject to appropriation, as it does, it's generally perceived now the earnings reserve is appropriable, and it gets reconstituted every year. I would feel better if it were actually considered to be part of the corpus of the fund. Now again, I don't know if that's a statute.
I'm not sure.
I don't know if that's a statutorial distinction or not. Go ahead.
I'm not sure that it's not. I mean, it is now currently invested as part of the permanent fund. What you're alluding to is what change that would have in the mix of liquid and non-liquid assets. Is that part of what you're?
No, what I'm saying is if we could take this reserves for permanent fund inflation proofing, that is the five-year average payout plan, and simply had that as an investment requirement in the fund, it wouldn't show up on the budget at all. It would simply be in the corpus of the permanent fund as a sub-account, and you would adjust essentially your paper assets and so forth to allow for that. I'm just thinking out loud about this constant public perception that you've got all this money in the bank. Why do we need to do any taxes? Why do we have to do the budget cuts? Why don't you just draw on these reserves? And having two different reserves with two different rules complicates what in this case is a financial management reserve in contrast to a budget reserve. And I prefer to have the financial management reserve in the financial management side of the house than in the budget side of the house.
Well, maybe we could just take a position that if there was a way to get some extra protection for the, some extra protection for that reserve, it would be nice, and maybe not try to design it in this report. Because I can't argue with that point. I think that it could be a slippery slope if you try to, maybe try to non-realize some unrealized gains inside the corpus, and you can get really... it might open up precedents that you don't want to have of how you recognize income if you try to do it just through accounting techniques. But the concept of trying to get some extra protection for it, I think, is a good concept. Maybe just leave it for some creative minds to figure out how to design.
But in some sense, if we're going to be looking at showing total spending now, which will include permanent funds, earnings and expenditures. Maybe it's partly in the presentation. I think I finally clicked with some of the concerns that you're raising. I wasn't understanding your point before. For purposes of showing people what is the money that's kind of available for spending on the budget as opposed to for the earnings stream off the permanent fund, we're going to show all that permanent fund earnings anyway, so why don't we treat it differently in the display of information to make it clear that this is managed by the permanent fund, the investments are handled by the permanent fund, the purposes all relate to the payout from the permanent fund. And I think, maybe there's a reason to do that statutorily as part of the five-year payout, but I don't know that would need to be done as a constitutional change. You certainly don't want to put it in the corpus. If it's in the corpus, you don't get it out anyway.
Well, I think there are actually significant constitutional questions about what defines the corpus. I don't know that we want to get into that now. Again, my two concerns have been that, number one, it winds up forcing a more conservative investment strategy on the part of the trustees, because now they not only invest their asset allocations based on a certain amount of security, that is, they invest their portfolio in order to maintain an investment strategy that yields a certain amount of income. That goes into the asset allocation, short-term versus long-term gains. And then they have another one set aside on top of that. Just if it's not taken into consideration, you've got a double conservation. But I'm comfortable with our conversation. Why don't we go on? As Steve said, we'll let other creative minds resolve this, where it's nestled and how it's shown.
Brad, can I?
If we're getting off of that, I just had a question, Brad, and I'm sorry I came in late. Did you have an answer on the scenario projection fours on the year between FY04 and FY05 of why the earnings dropped $450 million, permanent fund net earnings?
That was when SB51 was fully into effect. In other words, up until then, we were taking permanent fund earnings to general fund just to fill the hole there.
So where does that money go? I thought that the permanent fund earnings shown up there were everything except inflation proofing. Was that right? You have to refresh my memory. That third line down says permanent fund net earnings was two of the three components of use of the permanent fund. I can't remember which two of the three it was.
Okay, a permanent fund net earnings, and then it's minus the bottom line there, permanent fund earnings to general fund.
Okay.
In other words, we're not taking all the money that could be spun off of there. We started 100, and then we gradually phase in till 04, in which we take all the money.
Okay, I'm with you. I see that there.
And the other side of the equation there is that we're holding dividends somewhat artificially high, and we're bringing them down gradually until 2001. When the dividend amount at 511 equals what would, be in the bill.
Okay. And that's right.
And also, there's another sheet here that I put out today that showed what per capita dividends would be and how they would be ramped down and so forth.
Okay. To follow that through, could you explain, and I kind of follow that, at least I see how the two in total add up to a constant number. But then down, the line says transfer to earnings reserve, whereas in FY04 it's $448 million, and then in FY06 it's only 18. Where does that 18 million, where does that 400 some million dollars go that used to be there?
It's going into that's where the big jump is. In 05, it's all going into the general fund now.
I'm confused. Where's this number 14? Which composite scenario are we looking at?
That's number 4. It was published today. It's the same one that we had last night, only I changed the earnings assumption on it.
Okay, can you back that up to me?
Okay. Oh, yeah, I emailed it to you this morning.
Okay, but I haven't been in the office since 10:30, so
okay.
I don't have it.
Okay.
I'll get
it up there right now,
Brian.
Okay,
yeah,
thanks.
Brad, I don't want to belabor it now because I know we got things to do, but what it looks to me like, if you have total expenditures in FY06 of $4.757 million and FY04 of $4,739, which is a difference of only $20 million, and most of the other numbers up there are fairly consistent except for a much lower transfer to earnings reserve. And I know I'm missing something, but I'm not sure what I'm missing. Because
okay.
I see where you have a much higher permanent fund earnings to GF number, but that would be offset by something, by a reduction somewhere else, because the totals don't change.
500 each direction.
Each direction, yeah. It's the money that's not being transferred to the earnings reserve now.
Okay, if you have $400 million less money being transferred to the earnings reserve, and instead it's being put into the general fund. Where is the where is the relief on some other funding source that used to be filling that hole? You can't just add $400 million more into the general fund without spending going up by $400 million or some other revenue source dropping by $400 million.
Well, it looks to me like it's spread around. You've got some reduction in your traditional general fund sources. That's going down a little bit. You have some spending increases with inflation. The inflation proofing and the dividends are each going up.
If I read this, part of fund net earnings goes from 18 to 14, and transfers to earning reserve falls from 400 to negative.
Yeah. Why does permanent fund net earnings drop so precipitously in 05?
The earnings are net of the permanent fund going to GF, the last line there.
Oh, okay, got it.
So if you look at, if you add those, you know, or add them together, 94 is 2.1, 95 is 2.2.
Okay, we need to change that display. It's too confusing.
Yeah. Okay, you want it back up under, right under it?
Yes, and then maybe you could footnote CF earnings to GF right after the total revenues line or something.
Okay.
I see what you're trying. You're trying to solve the problem so you can actually see what the amount is that goes in. And I think that's good, but I think it maybe if you put the two those two lines together, permanent fund net earnings, not the GF, and then permanent fund net earnings to GF, those two lines right
okay.
Side to side, that'd do it.
If I can, okay, and then be down where you have CBR deposit to permanent fund principal. In between 04 and 05, it goes from 94 million to 384 million. Is that because you're taking that permanent fund income and putting it into the general fund, and then it kind of passes through and goes on to the CBR, and then from there to the principal?
Yeah.
Okay.
Okay. Describe it again.
If you want to smooth it out further, we can. I just thought that was a good year to fully implement the thing.
Yeah, okay. Well, I can see, and again, I know that, I think Bob gave my comment earlier about my concern, but in the years, and I'll just express it once more, in the years FY01 through 04, if you drew a circle around the line, the numbers under the line transfer to earnings reserve, which is about in the center of the page, it's 392, 428, 454, and 448, and drew a circle around the numbers that said income sales tax, the net effect is that the tax that's being raised is money that's going into the earnings reserve and from there to the principal of the permanent fund. And then if you drew a circle around the numbers under CBR deposit to permanent fund principal starting in 2005 and going on out, and drew a circle again around the line saying income sales tax, to some extent, but less so, the net effect is that the income and sales tax is passing through and becoming a deposit to the permanent fund principal. And that holds till about FY06 or 07. So
That was intentional. That was part of the, I forget which plan or which scenario, somebody's, who wanted to beef up the permanent fund so principal so that earnings in the out years, especially after 2005, when we were showing big deficits there, before with just the Ranger plan or just SB51, that would help to offset those.
Okay. Yeah. So I will re-express my concern about that. I know Bob read it. That I will have, you know, when it comes time to really considering these, have heartburn with raising taxes where the net effect is to beef up the permanent fund and no other purpose. So just state it again.
Steve.
Yes.
Steve, the alternative. As it appears to me, the alternative is that we don't implement anything earlier on, and then when we do find ourselves in these out years, having the deficits, the magnitude again puts us where we are right now, which is we're looking at deficits And even if we take some of the out-year savings that we've been talking about, we still have the problem that at some point our oil revenues are going down sufficiently that we have to beef up the permanent fund in order to get more earnings off of it. Now, we still have the opportunity in year 01, 00, whatever, to reconsider based on what may happen with AMR, Gasline, et cetera. But that's why I think it's really important that we lay out for people that the assumptions we're making here is that there is not major new oil development and that we're having to accommodate a substantial decline in the crude oil curve, but that we will have a choice in another 5 years when we have much better information about what's going to happen with oil revenue.
Yeah, I hear that. I know where I will be on that issue at that time. But I guess the question is which scenario we show as kind of the commission's plan.
I think there. I think one of the options is that we show that in year 01, 00, whatever, at the point where we balance the budget or right in that vicinity, I think we should show that at that point the state will again have a series of choices, which, you know, in part will depend on what happens with new oil revenue. But we'll have a choice to go back for more budget cuts beyond just the efficiency kind of things that we're going to try to do straight on through, to do an income tax, or to say we're in okay shape and come from this other stuff and we don't need it. But one of the concerns that we've all addressed is that right now we have no income source in the state of Alaska that's population related. And I think it's worth at least flagging that as a major consideration. So that economic growth right now does not help our fiscal gap unless it's oil money.
Well, Brad, I'd like to...
I think it's at least worth raising as an issue.
Maybe, Brad, what you could do is a three-dimensional graph, and then you have a fork in the road at year 2000, and one goes off with this plan and one with not doing it. Okay.
Steve, I think in order to do that time-weighted, you have to do a four-dimensional graph.
Let me think about that.
Well, again... My suggestion would be pay attention to real dollars instead of nominal dollars, and the picture begins to provide a little more clarity in terms of what's actually happening. But
we've reached the midpoint of the meeting. I want to take about a 5-minute break here and then return. We let the scenario grab us again, and we need to go back to text and work on getting this text reviewed. And still deal with the how we're going to treat in tabular form the federal and all and other funds. So it's 3:00 by 3:01 by my watch. We'll start up again at 3:10. Okay. George Anna just made a comment that I think is real appropriate. That this whole issue of how we deal with the reserve is assuming no endowment plan, if there's no endowment plan, is really a difficult issue. And I think one of the reasons for that is we don't really have other state models to go on. Nobody else has the same problem with volatility that we do, and nobody has the luxury of the big reserves that we do.
Brian?
Yes.
I'd like to offer a suggestion for how we deal with with an overall plan. It sounds to me like we're really in agreement on what we should be doing between now and FY00, and that in that time period we can comfortably recommend a way to close the fiscal gap and have a couple of years of a sustainable, at least beginnings of a sustainable situation. And I think we're starting to get so far out that that's where we're running into difficulty, at a point where our choices are very different and information will be very different. I'd like to suggest that we take our scenario and break it into two pieces. We have a scenario for now through 00, the first 5 years, and then we, on a separate page, show some projections that go out, make it clear that this becomes much more iffy, that there's we have the things we know of the the normal kinds of revenues and so on. And then we lay out the size of a projected gap that would need to be filled either by what we learn will be happening with additional oil revenues, gas lines, whatever, or budget cut, and or income tax, and or something else. But I think we're doing a good job of looking out, but we're getting hung up on looking out so far. And I'd like to take a cut at maybe putting that into two chunks and seeing if we can display the second piece with choices rather than with assumptions the way it looks like it is here. You know, assuming an oil tax, assuming an income tax, assuming no additional oil revenue, et cetera.
I'm personally attracted to that idea as making our job simpler, but I think we miss one of our charges, which is the 10-year sustainable plan. And I think we may, if we are in a position of deferring the income tax to the second set, we may lose some of our support for the budget cut at the early end.
Good point.
You've already lost some of the support because I guess I haven't bought in yet that I think 40, 30, 30 is an adequate buy.
I'm 40, 30, 30 has such a good ring to it. Well, what about 40, 30, 30, 20, 20?
It loses balance where 60, 50, 40, 30 has this progression.
Gets
180,
okay?
Mr. Chairman?
Yes, sir.
I'm almost fine with taking increasing oil taxes off the table. I think what you said the other day was sharing it with all sectors. I don't see where, other than the lift ANS export ban, where oil's kicked in anything on here.
The sound's working. I heard it, but I'm not going to react because if I can't be nice, there's no sense being anything.
I have this feeling we're on this wheel going around in circles, and the wheel just started spinning faster, and we got some people falling off the end. I'm not sure how we keep everybody on this bus. Bruce, did you have a specific idea for what level of oil taxation you'd want to see as part of this?
I'd like to see $100 million somewhere during the 10 years. And I don't care if it comes from increased production somehow or it comes from increased taxes. But I'd like to see that share of it go up that way.
Well, Hugh, how do you think the industry could we get the industry to respond positively if we said we want to bank on $100 million more in oil industry revenues, and it's up to you whether to make it up through production or pay more on the production you have?
I suspect if you were to approach the industry with something that had an incentive for additional drilling or additional development, i.e., put in the $100 million tax, but then pair it with a credit for actual expenditures on development of additional fields or exploration or development of additional fields. So the companies that are paying the tax have an opportunity to further enhance the permanent fund through actual activities of work. But at that stage, I haven't seen any. You're going to have some fairly significant cuts, and you're going to have some sharing on the part of some folks that just say, no, everything we're spending now is about right, and we ought to leave it about there, because it's, and all I'm saying is that the baseline kind of budgeting that starts fairly high and ramps up forever won't work. You can't fund it.
You, within your 60-50-40-30, what are you assuming we're doing with deferred maintenance? Are you assuming that we're cutting in addition to that and dealing with deferred maintenance? Or are you assuming that we're dealing with it through the dedicated motor fuel tax or something else?
I guess, Brian, part of my problem is I have never really understood exactly how you deal with deferred maintenance when exactly the same players are going to be receiving the money and determining how the money is going to be spent. That put us in the mode of having the deferred maintenance to begin with. So how you can force compliance with something that is always going to be on the back burner as compared to something with a better lobby. I've never really understood it.
We struggled with that issue a lot at the university after finding ourselves with the big deferred maintenance backlog and with inadequate maintenance funding. And ultimately, what it took was firm and stringent direction from the top with the Board of Regents adopting a policy that said to each of the campuses, you know, here's the formula that we've accepted as being the appropriate formula for annual maintenance and then for major maintenance. We apply it to all the buildings, and you're short of that number right now. We have 3 years to reallocate away from other things to bring that into compliance. You can ask the legislature for new money. But if you don't get it, you have to cut program in order to do it. And over a three-year period, I think we're in the second year of that three-year period, in terms of ensuring you know, there's no more backlog. And Lee's sitting there trying to figure out where he's going to cut program to finish picking that up next year. It's not an easy choice, but the board had to do that. And you know, I guess the state parallel would be the governor and the legislature telling agencies, you know, forcing the budget and making some sort of commitment to do that. The problem is it's much easier for the legislature to vote for funding for a new building that they can stand in front of a ribbon cutting. It's hard to stand in front of a ribbon cutting for a new heating and ventilating system. It's hard to stand, you know, be at a groundbreaking for a roof repair. And I'm not sure how absent, you know, the firm direction, I guess, from the governor, or a dedicated fund, how we ever get there. I share your concern about it because if we really struggled with it a long time at the university, even after the university leadership had said, this is a priority we've got to deal with. Does anybody else have ideas for how we deal with this maintenance issue within a cut scenario?
Well, the approach that we're taking is along the lines of what Brian has said. We haven't formalized it yet across all agencies in terms of saying, here's the formula to be applied. We're just taking the first steps on that. I think the biggest part is going to come in 98, because we're some different things how we handle the allocation of costs for space to begin with. But that is the approach we're going to be taking, and saying that, I mean, that's why, one of the reasons why, to me, the 40-30-30 cut is aggressive to begin with, because we're talking about doing that at a time when, if you add in the deferred maintenance, it's a cut to other activities that's more substantial than the 40-30-30. So, I don't think we are, I mean, it's certainly not our intention to ignore it. Obviously, the proof will be in the pudding, but I would like to point out, though, that the scenarios that we're looking at do not just run the budget up endlessly, though. If you look at real dollars, total expenditures in FY96 are 3.4